Matthew chapter 82, verses 47 and 48, Krishna meets the inhabitants of Vrindavan. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We'll chant the first verse together. Sri Shuka Uvacha. Adhyatma Shiksaya Gopya. Evam Krishnena Shiksita. Tad anusmara nadvasta jivako shastamadyagan Sri Shuka Uvacha Adhyatma Siksaya Gopya Evam Krishnena Siksita Tad anusmara nadvasta jivako sastamadyagan Sri Shuka Uvacha adhyatma siksaya gopya evam krishnena siksita Tad anusmara nadvasta jivako sastamadyagan Shuka Uvacha Adhyatma Siksaya Gopya Evam Krishnena Siksita Tadanusmara Nadvasta Sivako Sasta Madhyagan Sri Shuka Uvacha Adhyatma Siksaya Gopya Evam Krishnena Siksita Tadanusmara Nadvasta Jivako Sasta Madhyagan Sri Shuka Uvacha Sri Sukadev Goswami said Adhyatma about the soul, Siksaya, with instruction, Gopya, the gopis, Evam, thus, Krishnena, by Krishna, Sikshitaha, taught, Tat, on him. Anusmarana, by constant meditation. Vasta, eradicated. Jiva Kosha, the subtle covering of the soul, false ego. Tam, him. Adyagan, they came to understand. Translation. Sukadeva Goswami said, having thus been instructed by Krishna in spiritual matters, the gopis were freed of all tinges of false ego because of their incessant meditation upon him. And with their deepening absorption in him, they came to understand him fully. Purport. Srila Prabhupada renders this passage as follows in Krishna. The gopis, having been instructed by Krishna in this philosophy of simultaneous oneness and difference, remained always in Krishna consciousness and thus became liberated from all material contamination. The consciousness of the living entity who falsely presents himself as the enjoyer of the material world is called Jiva Kosha, which means imprisonment by the false ego. Not only the gopis, but anyone who follows these instructions of Krishna becomes immediately freed from the Jiva Kosha imprisonment. A person in full Krishna consciousness is always liberated from false egoism. He utilizes everything for Krishna's service and is not at any time separated from Krishna. In verse 48, Ahuscha tenalina naba padara vindam. Samsara kupa patito taranavalambam geham jusama pimanasyu diryat sadana. Let's try that one more time. Ahustachati nalina navapadaravindam yogeshvairairi divichintya magada bodhai samsara kupa patito taranavalambam Yeham jusam apimanas yudiyat sadavana. Translation. The gopis spoke thus. Dear Lord, whose navel is just like a lotus flower, your lotus feet are the only shelter for those who have fallen into the deep well of material existence. Your feet are worshipped and meditated upon by great mystic yogis and highly learned philosophers. We wish that these lotus feet may also be awakened within our hearts, although we are only ordinary persons engaged in household affairs. Purport. The translation and word meaning for this verse are taken from Srila Prabhupada's English rendering of Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya 181, where this verse is quoted. Revealing the jealous mood in which the gopis spoke these deceptively reverential words, Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti gives their statements as follows. O Supreme Lord, O directly manifest Supersoul, O crest jewel of instructors in definitive knowledge, you are aware of our excessive attachment to home, property, and family. Therefore, you previously had Uddhava instruct us in the knowledge that dispels ignorance, and now you have done so yourself. In this way, you have purified our hearts of contamination, and as a result, we understand your pure love for us, free from any motivation other than assuring our liberation. But we are only unintelligent cowherd women. How can this knowledge remain fixed in our hearts? We cannot even meditate steadily on your feet, the focus of realization for great souls like Lord Brahma. Please be merciful to us, and somehow make it possible for us to concentrate on you, even a little. We are still suffering the reactions of our fruitive work, so how can we meditate on you, the goal of great yogis? Such yogis are immeasurably wise, but we are mere feeble-minded women. Please do something to get us out of this deep well of material life. Pure devotees are never motivated by a desire for material elevation or spiritual liberation. And even if the Lord offers them such benedictions, the devotees often refuse to accept them. As stated by Lord Krishna in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, 11:20-34, Nachit kinchit sadodira bhaktaye kantino mama vachanti api maya datam kaivalyam apunar bhavam. Because my devotees possess saintly behavior and deep intelligence, they completely dedicate themselves to me and do not desire anything besides me. Indeed, if I offer them liberation from birth and death, they do not accept it. It is quite appropriate, therefore, that the gopis respond with a trace of jealous anger to Lord Krishna's attempt at teaching them Jnana Yoga. Thus, according to Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur, the words the gopis speak in this verse may be interpreted as follows. O sun, who directly destroys the darkness of ignorance, we are scorched by the sun rays of this philosophical knowledge. We are chakora birds who can subsist only on the moonlit radiating on the moonlight radiating from your beautiful face. Please come back to Vrindavan with us, and in this way bring us back to life. And if he says, then come to Dwarka, there we'll enjoy together. They reply that Sri Vrindavan is their home, and they are too attached to it for them to take up residence anywhere else. Only there, the gopis imply, can Krishna attract them by wearing peacock feathers in his turban and playing enchanting music with his flute. Only by his appearing again in Vrindavan can the gopis be saved, not by any other kind of meditation on him or theoretical knowledge of the self. Thus end the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 10th canto, 82nd chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam entitled Krishna and Balaram Meet the Inhabitants of Vrindavan. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Shakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So I want to begin by thanking Divyanga Prabhu for singling out yesterday those of us who consider ourselves too fallen to sit on the Vyasasan or do this or that service. As he explained, Prabhupada says that attachment to service to Krishna is the topmost priority, even if our sadhana is sometimes not perfect. How are we to deny sharing Krishna consciousness to others based on our so-called humility? So thank you for that encouragement. So with these two verses, we're ending this chapter called Krishna and Balaram Meet the Inhabitants of Vrindavan. And in the previous verse, the gopis have expressed their disappointment to Krishna for having left them in Vrindavan so many years ago. And Krishna responds to them through these different philosophical points on why they shouldn't lament his absence. He explains that he is the beginning and end of all created beings. He exists within and without them. And in this way, we're always together, he says. If you know that I'm the Supreme Lord, there should be no question of suffering separation from me. The great yogis know this. But according to Vishwanath Chakravarti's purport, the gopis, through their deceptively reverential words, reject Krishna's reference to meditation on Paramatma, Jnana Yoga, and liberation, which are useless to them compared to the pure love that they have. So Krishna is trying to pacify the gopis by explaining this philosophy, but they're pretty much saying, yeah, that's great, but just come back to Vrindavan. They want him to come back not only because he's their everything, but also because they're not satisfied by the Krishna of Mathura and Dwarka, who appears in a different dress and displays a different mood. It's kind of like if you're related or have a deep affection for someone who happens to be the president of a country or a high court judge. When he appears in his workplace, he has to wear a certain dress, and he's to be addressed with a certain kind of reverence. But if you know him more personally in his home and his natural, comfortable environment where he grew up, like with them in Vrindavan, that's the Krishna that the gopis are attached to. And that's why they want him to come back to Vrindavan. Through the gopis, the supremacy of Krishna Prema is being highlighted here as the topmost form of relationship that we can have with the Lord. We also know that the gopis are not ordinary people. They are the most highly elevated beings in all of creation, really. Yet they're demonstrating ultimate humility by expressing that they're just ordinary persons engaged in household affairs. So we can see that there are different dynamics happening here in this Leela. The gopis are being somewhat mischievous in their dealings with Krishna by rejecting his philosophy. Yet they're also sincerely humble in considering themselves to be lower than the great yogis and sages who meditate on his lotus feet. And ultimately, they are the award that will ultimately be given to these great sages. So it's interesting to see the different aspects here. So what should be our position when we read these verses, which are so far beyond our reach? You know, after all, we're in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam here. It's the culmination of so many other cantos and pages of philosophy. Is this a similar case to Arjuna, where the gopis are under the spell of Yoga Maya for the purpose of teaching us this philosophy? And that's a valid explanation, but it might take away from the value of them being real people with real emotions. So is there a deeper meaning to these verses? Well, let's try to examine them in both ways. If we were to take this on face value, we'll find important instructions that we can apply in Krishna's philosophy to the gopis, to our own lives. They're expressing to Krishna, "We're just ordinary persons engaged in household affairs. Please awaken your lotus feet within our hearts so that we may worship you and meditate upon you like the great mystic yogis." So we can relate to this mood of humility, for example, when we think of Srila Prabhupada and all that he's done for us, leaving India at the age of 70 and leaving Vrindavan behind and sacrificing his family life for the benefit of all of humanity, suffering, you know, heart attacks on an old cargo ship to bring this message to the Western world. It's so humbling, you know, who are we compared to that? But we can take example in the gopis here. We may also feel insignificant considering our engagement in household affairs. But Krishna explains, if we are always thinking of him in all that we do, all of our activities are considered transcendental. So what does transcendental mean? It means that we're no longer bound to the material laws of karma, reaction to our activities. We're no longer bound to the law of repeated birth and death, old age and disease, and the threefold miseries that are associated as ingredients of this material world, suffering caused by the self, caused by others, and caused by the environment. When we act in thoughts of Krishna, even if it's through our household affairs, we are transcendental, meaning that we are now on the spiritual platform, and whatever we do is going to eternally benefit us in our eternal relationship with Krishna and bring us closer to that ultimate goal. So for the householders out there, we've chosen to be servants of our families and to be responsible for them financially, for their education, for their health, their happiness, and ultimately for teaching them and helping them how to achieve the ultimate goal of life through the practice of Krishna consciousness. And this is a great responsibility, which is to be taken very seriously. But what does that mean to take it seriously? Well, it means that we do these things to the best of our ability while always thinking of Krishna as the ultimate goal. As it was explained yesterday in class, it's better to perform, you know, a material job or taking care of one's family in meditation on Krishna as the ultimate goal than to be serving him directly on the altar if we're thinking about frivolous sports or other mundane affairs. So our consciousness is the key to perfection in all that we do, which is why our movement is called Krishna Consciousness. What is the number one rule? To always remember Krishna and never forget him. So let's take example from the wonderful gopis who describe themselves as ordinary women, also engaged in household affairs, but who yet are not one bit distracted from their constant meditation on Krishna and everything that they do. Krishna is actually reminding the gopis of so many ways by which the advanced devotee remembers him. And he knows that they are never separated. And the best thing we can do is to take Krishna's instructions and try to apply them. So I found a couple of Prabhupada stories that relate to these verses. In yesterday's verse, Krishna says, you should see both of these, the material creation and the self, as manifest within me, the imperishable truth. So I have a passage here. This is out of Swami in a Strange Land, which is my father Yogeshwar's new book coming out in May, I believe. It's a fresh perspective on the life and teachings of Srila Prabhupada, and it's available at a Krishna store near you. Pre-orders may be made on Amazon as well. All right, we got that out of the way. All right, so here we are. We're going back to the early days, and the passage goes like this. It was a beautiful October night, and some of the initiated devotees decided to chant in the courtyard between Matchless Gift and the Swami's apartment building. They sat on a bench and looked up into a clear night sky. "It's a beautiful moon," said one devotee. "That's Maya," said another, "an illusion." Sparking a debate about whether anything material could be beautiful, the group decided to bring the question to the Swami. "For devotees," he explained, "this world is as good as Vaikuntha," using the Sanskrit term for the eternal world, the place which is without, vai, anxiety, kunta. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "The sun and moon are his eyes. When a devotee looks at the moon, he sees Krishna." Nonetheless, a disciple suggested, the perceivable world was subject to change, so there had to be some differences between matter and spirit. "It is our consciousness, then, that determines whether something is material or spiritual," he asked. "Yes," the Swami acknowledged, for one who has attained higher stages of spiritual realization, there is nothing material. Such a person sees everything as Brahman. Still, Krishna speaks of having superior and inferior energies. How is that? Because without the touch of spirit, matter cannot work. Therefore, it is called inferior. But in a higher sense, it is not inferior because matter also emanates from the Supreme. Just like electricity can run a cold refrigerator or a hot stove, one who knows the nature of electricity knows that the same energy is working whether hot or cold, inferior or superior. So on the platform of real knowledge, there is no distinction between matter and spirit. The world itself, from that perspective, was spiritual, and he had come to America to teach how to see Krishna in the details of the everyday world. Krishna consciousness meant recognizing that commonplace minutia held as much importance as peak experiences, that Krishna could be found in everything. He dwelled not only in a faraway eternal universe, but in each atom and between each atom. That one lesson could radically change the way people related to the world around them, since respecting the earth and the environment from the Vedic perspective was a spiritual imperative. Everything was God's energy. Hayagriva remembered being in the Swami's apartment recently and making room by shoving the typewriter aside with his foot. Don't touch that with your foot, the Swami scolded. It's spiritual. Well, aren't my feet spiritual? Hayagriva asked. Yes, in the service of Krishna, everything is spiritual. But even with your spiritual foot, you should not disrespect a spiritual typewriter. You will understand this in time. So, an advanced devotee understands that the material energy is also coming from Krishna, and that in that sense, the material energy is spiritual. Krishna dedicates an entire chapter in Bhagavad Gita to describing how we can see him in all these beautiful different natural elements of nature, material nature. Another time, Prabhupada was also asked, what do you see when you see a tree? And Prabhupada said, well, a pure devotee sees the soul in the tree body and the super soul sitting next to the individual soul. So a devotee always sees Krishna at all times. So that's one way that we can look at these verses and learn from them, studying the interaction between Krishna and the gopis here. But now if we don't just take it as a potential literary device to teach us something, we are obliged to go deeper into the emotions involved to understand the reasons behind what is being said and really get the full value of these verses. This is where it's great to have the purports of great acharyas such as Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur. The gopis and other residents of Vrindavan are suffering. Their hearts are aching terribly in separation of Krishna. They never wanted him to leave Vrindavan, and now seeing him wearing his royal garb, it's uncomfortable for them. They don't like seeing him like this. Behind the gopis' response, there's an existential emotion going on that's very powerful. And Krishna is doing his best to pacify them, explaining how I'm always with you in these different philosophical ways, but in this case, the philosophy only goes so far, as we can see in their response. Even though they're being polite, the gopis are actually begging Krishna to please come back. We can imagine how in their minds they're thinking, Krishna, what are you doing? We just want you to come back to Vrindavan. It's so deep and so pure that when Krishna sees the love of his gopis, he actually feels totally helpless and unable to reciprocate the amount of love that they have for him. And this is not a cheap thing. We're so far from being able to actually understanding the depths of these relationships that it's easy to misjudge them. We're kind of like the the frog in a well, where the frog is limited to this world contained within a small well, but meanwhile there's an entire universe out there. So similarly, we have our own experiences in this material world, but there's so much more beyond. If we think of Krishna's behavior and pastimes based on our own experiences, a lot of times we would just walk away. I have a young devotee friend who really struggles with the relationship of Krishna and the gopis. Similarly, when the British Empire took over India, they read these passages in the scriptures and totally disregarded them and posted Krishna as some immoral person. But personally, I don't find it so difficult to understand. I kind of compare it to this one time when I was in college. I came in late to a calculus class, and on the blackboard, I saw all these complicated formulas, you know, pi this and square root of that. And it's totally confusing, you know, when we see something like that, it makes no sense. But at the same time, we have faith that there is a perfect logical explanation that can be achieved when we have the proper degree to understand it. This is why Srila Prabhupada says that, you know, we should read the entire Bhagavatam from the beginning with all the other cantos before we can fully grasp what's explained in the 10th canto. Look at the glimpse that a pure devotee like Srila Prabhupada can give us into the spiritual depths of these pastimes. In Krishna book, he describes the scene that just happened as follows. Because they had been separated from Krishna for so many years, the gopis, having come along with Nanda Maharaj and Mother Yasoda, felt intense ecstasy upon seeing Krishna. No one can even imagine how eager the gopis were to see Krishna again. As soon as Krishna became visible to them, they took him inside their hearts, through their eyes, and embraced him to their full satisfaction. Even though they were embracing Krishna only mentally, they became so ecstatic and overwhelmed with joy that for the time being they completely forgot themselves. The ecstatic trance they achieved simply by mentally embracing Krishna is impossible to achieve even for great yogis constantly engaged in meditation on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna could understand that the gopis were wrapped in ecstasy by embracing him in their minds, and therefore, since he is present in everyone's heart, he reciprocated the embracing from within. So the only recourse for us is to fall down on the ground and beg for mercy for some service so that someday we may be able to enter into these realms of this amazing Krishna consciousness. Another example of the frog in the well is that after Krishna appeared in this world in the prison house of King Kamsa, and Vasudev carried him across the Yamuna River to bring him to the shelter of Nanda Maharaj and Mother Yasoda, the waters were so rough that Krishna almost fell out of the basket he was being carried in. Vasudev's anxiety in that moment was pure ecstasy. And it's inconceivable for us to try to compare this to our own experiences. I mean, have any of you ever had a potential accident with your own child, leaving them on the couch and, you know, they almost fall? And that is not ecstasy. So in our world, this kind of sadness, anxiety, it actually shortens the duration of life. It leads to depression. But in the spiritual world, these emotions enhance the love for Krishna. This is why ultimately the gopis accepted to go back to Vrindavan on Krishna's order, because their love and separation was the highest ecstasy. Another fascinating thing to look at in these verses is this humility that's being displayed by the personalities of the gopis. Here the most exalted devotees in the entire creation feel themselves as being nothing. It's a total 180 degrees from what we know in the material world, where recognition, pride of our accomplishments is more powerful than anything. You know, we might consider it even more powerful than the sex desire. Nobody wants to die meaningless. We all want to die with some value. Yet the most perfect examples here of pure devotees have absolutely no interest in any kind of recognition. And the gopis are not pretending here. They're not putting on a show. They really think that they are the most fallen. And yet at the same time, they're not oblivious of who they are. They are full of knowledge, Sachidananda. You know, they're the highest devotees. They speak of themselves as ignorant cowherd women, but yet they manage to have Krishna under their control by their love. Now, this is a really amazing concept. So what's the interference for us? Why aren't we engaging in similar pastimes with Krishna? Well, once again, let's take the Bhagavatam statements on face value and apply them to ourselves. Sukadev Goswami says that, having thus been instructed by Krishna, the gopis were freed of all tinges of false ego because of their constant meditation upon him. How is it possible to become free from our false ego, which is the greatest impediment? Well, if we understand what it is, maybe we can have a better chance at it. Now, this will be the last point. The dictionary defines the word ego to be our conscious mind, the part of your identity that you consider yourself. It's a psychological term popularized by Freud to describe the awareness of one's own identity and existence. Interestingly, consciousness, which hasn't been clearly defined by science, is what we know to be the symptom of the soul. And the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita explains that the true self is the eternal spirit soul, which animates these temporary bodies that we inhabit. In the material world, the soul is covered by a number of temporary selves, namely the gross and subtle bodies. The gross body is the flesh and bones and the five senses, and the subtle body is the mind, intelligence, and the false ego. These temporary coverings are the means by which we can engage with the world around us, but they can also cloud our remembrance of our original eternal identity. So the real ego is that we are eternal spirits, sparks of God with same qualities of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. And our constitutional position is to engage in a loving relationship with the Supreme Lord. When we understand this, then the dictionary definition is correct in defining the ego as consciousness of the self. But because it doesn't acknowledge the existence of the soul and is defining this only based on one's experience of existence through the gross and subtle bodies, it can be accepted as a valid definition of the word ego. Rather, according to the Vedas, this bodily concept of the self is what is called the false ego, which Prabhupada describes here as the jiva kosha imprisonment. This imprisonment is the mistaken impression that we are the body and mind by which we shrink our self-identity to various titles, such as man, woman, young or old, American, Indian, French, so many different nationalities, white or black, Muslim or Jew, rich or poor, etc. This is the conditioning of forgetfulness we're subjected to in the material world. And why is it important to understand this distinction? It's because if we identify with these false labels, that is actually the cause and the root cause of all suffering that happens in the material world. In the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, verse 71, Krishna says, Vihaya kamanya sarvan pumans charati nispriha nirmamo nirahankara sasantim adigachati. A person who has given up all desires for sense gratification, who lives free from desires, who has given up all sense of proprietorship, is devoid of false ego, and is devoid of false ego, he alone can attain real peace. So there are so many ways to learn from any one single verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. I'm always amazed whenever I finally force myself to prepare a class, how many directions I can go in, and how much supporting information there is from our great acharyas. We've been invited into the highest elevated platforms of self-awareness and God realization, and it takes years and years of practice to really appreciate them. So when we read these verses, we have to accept that there are other dimensions at work here and have faith that they can be achieved through the gradual process of sadhana bhakti and by the mercy of Krishna and his devotees. So I'll end there if there are any questions or comments. No? Yes, Prabhu. From who?
From you.
Sandra Reyes.
She is the psychiatrist professor. She teaches to the PhD student.
Uh-huh.
But she, I don't know for a while. When you talk about ego, the conception in the Western psychological world do not recognize ego as an eternal existence. Ego, they think, is something you need to get rid of.
Right.
But Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam describe it in details that ego is the self. Ego has nothing to do with their emotional nature. So in Balladevi Dawasin Bhagavatam, Govinda Vaishya explains that ego, when the soul desires by seeing the allure activities of illusory energy to enjoy separately, independently from Krishna, then an ego hides the soul with the matter. And that matter, Prabhupada explained, has a two aspects. One is subtle, one is gross. So that's called Hridaya Granthi. The heart has a knot. So soul by nature, according to Brahma Samhita, do not have any inclination to enjoy material sense enjoyment or sense gratification. But when they develop a desire, this material nature, material world, the Lord or Master is Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva has a legitimate eternal right to enjoy sense gratification as much he wants. And there's nothing wrong. That's his world. Maya is his maid servant, his wife. So she's serving him. But the soul does not have that. But the soul, when he comes with the contact, with the desire to enjoy, then that conception of Shiva enters into the soul. That is false. And how to get out? The 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, I believe it's 61. Machitta sarva durgani mat prasada parishati ata cheta ahankara. There is it, written, ahankara, possible. Nashusrasi vinashusrasi. Krishna says you will be finished if you do not pay attention on my topics. Sarva. So when the soul comes in contact with the sadhu and sarva, then false ego is revealed. Until that, false ego never disappears by jnani, yogi, karmi, whatever it is they call. They have to be engaged in devotional service.
Thank you. It's true that the dictionary actually also mentions this other definition of the ego, which is this more common use, which is associated with, you know, megalomania and selfishness and things like that. But yes, thanks for that explanation of the inner workings of the false ego and how, until we're exposed to Krishna consciousness by the mercy of the devotees, there's no way out of it. Yes, Prabhu.
Very nice class. Thank you. We're talking about thinking about Krishna and keeping Krishna conscious. We were mentioning yesterday, and today you brought it up, you can be dressing the deities and thinking of other things. Just like we all have experienced, it's a lot easier to be Krishna conscious in the temple, dressing deities amongst the devotees, Mangal Arati, all those kind of activities. It's easier, but it's still not easy because I can speak personally. I sit in the temple room and chant my rounds every day, and I solve so many of my problems during that japa period. So, I mean, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. But I get caught doing it, and I'm get, you know, the result that I wanted. I figured out how I was supposed to do this. And I'm like, well, just be chanting. Oh, I am chanting. No, you're not chanting. You're not listening. So if we're having issues with it on the altar and thinking who won the game last week, or we're sitting in the temple room chanting amongst devotees, and thinking, you know, I just figured out what I have to do tomorrow at 12 o'clock. So if that is hard to do it in this atmosphere, how do we possibly do it when we're flying a plane or you know, going grocery shopping and checking out, you know, the different cereal labels and doing all this kind of stuff. How do we stay Krishna conscious in that environment?
Well, I can share my experience with that. You know, obviously, yes, I think we all have the tendency of, you know, the mind is fickle and it's uncontrollable like the wind, and whether we're in our workplace or even in the association of devotees, the mind is still very difficult to control. Arjuna was speaking with Krishna directly and he was feeling that his mind was impossible to control. So that's a natural tendency as a, you know, a result of our conditioning and just being exposed to the material world. So we shouldn't let that discourage us. You know, the practice is that when the mind gets taken away, we simply bring it back with no feelings of guilt or being, you know, down on ourselves. We just keep on with the process with faith and surrender. Now, yes, what to speak of being out in the workplace in that crazy, heavy material atmosphere. In one sense, it is a lot more difficult to think of Krishna. On the other hand, it's also the most amazing and special and intimate opportunity that Krishna is giving us. Why are we in the workplace? Krishna wants us to be in the workplace. Every single thing that happens to us in our life at every minute is Krishna's desire. It's his gift for us to use as a stepping stone to come towards him. So when we're in these heavy environments, what a great opportunity, and it's actually the most conducive atmosphere for us to really sincerely surrender to Krishna. We realize, oh my gosh, where am I? I'm so just pulled in every direction by these material energies. My dear Lord, please let me never forget you. You know? So this is how we should take advantage of those situations.
Yes, I agree with you. Prabhupada putting it like a Krishna boy. Yes, I agree with you. It's very difficult to control. But then he gave the medicine.
By practice.
You do these two things, you will be able to control and stay in Krishna boy. One is practice. Even if I cannot focus on Krishna, still I have to go on practicing. This is Krishna's advice. So keep on practicing and develop automatically unfavorable things away from the detachment level. These two things. And Krishna said, you will achieve.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we should encourage each other to practice.
Thank you. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.